For Shasa, everything seemed to happen at once. Sean's expulsion from Bishop's was a bombshell that ripped through Weltevrieden. When it happened, Shasa was in Johannesburg, and they had to call him out of a meeting with the representatives of the Chamber of Mines to receive the headmaster's telephone call. On the open line, the headmaster would give no details, and Shasa flew back to Cape Town immediately and drove directly from the airfield to the school. Flabbergasted and seething with anger at the stark details the headmaster gave him, Shasa sent the Jaguar roaring around the lower slopes of Table Mountain towards Weltevrieden. From the first, he had not approved of the woman who Tara had installed in the cottage. She was all the things he despised, with her great sloppy breasts and silly pretensions, which she thought made her avant-garde and artistic. Her paintings were atrocious, daubed primary colours and childish perspectives, and she tried to conceal her lack of talent and taste behind Portuguese cigarettes, sandals and skirts of blindingly vivid designs. He decided to deal with her first. However, she had fled, leaving the cottage in slovenly disarray. Thwarted, Shasa took his anger unabated up to the big house and shouted at Tara as he stormed into the hall. "Where's the little blighter? I'm going to skin his backside for him!" The other children, all three of them, were peeking over the railing from the second-floor gallery, in a fine fever of vicarious terror. Isabella's eyes were as enormous as one of Walt Disney's fawns. Shasa saw them and roared up the stairwell, "Back to your own rooms this instant! That goes for you as well, young lady!" And they ducked and scampered. As an afterthought, Shasa bellowed after them, "And tell that brother of yours I want to see him in the gunroom immediately!" The three of them raced each other down the passage of the nursery wing, each of them determined to be the bearer of the dreaded summons. The gunroom was the family equivalent of Tower Green, where all executions took place. Garrick got there first and pounded on Sean's locked door. "Pater wants you immediately," he yelled. "In the gunroom," Michael joined in, and Isabella, who had been left far behind at the start, piped up breathlessly, "He's going to skin your backside!" She was flushed and trembling with eagerness, and she hoped desperately that Sean would show her his bottom after Daddy had carried out his threat. She couldn't imagine what it would look like, and she wondered if Daddy would have the skin made into a floor mat like the skins of the zebras and lions in the gunroom. It was probably the most exciting thing that had ever happened in her whole life. In the entrance hall, Tara was attempting to calm Shasa. She had seen him in a comparable rage only two or three times during their marriage, always when he fancied the family honour or reputation had been compromised. Her efforts were in vain, for he turned on her with his single eye glittering. "Damn you, woman! This is mostly your fault. It was you who insisted on bringing that whore to live on Weltevrieden." As Shasa stormed off to the gunroom, his voice carried clearly up the stairwell to where Sean was bracing himself to come down and face retribution. Up to that moment, Sean had been so confused by the speed of events that he hadn't been thinking clearly. Now, as he descended the stairs, his mind was racing as he prepared his defence. He passed his mother, still standing in the middle of the chessboard, black-and-white marble squares of the entrance hall floor, and she gave him a restrained smile of encouragement. "I tried to help, darling," she whispered. They had never been close, but now, for once, Shaza's rage made them allies. "Thank you, Mater." He knocked on the gunroom door and opened it cautiously when his father roared. He closed it carefully behind him and advanced to the centre of the lionskin, where he halted and stood to attention. Beatings at Weltevrieden followed an established ritual. The riding crops were laid out on the bay's gun table, five of them of various lengths, weights and stinging potential. He knew his father would make a show of selecting the correct one for the occasion, and that today it would almost certainly be the long, whippy whalebone. Involuntarily, he looked to the overstuffed leather chair beside the fireplace over which he would be asked to drape himself, reaching over to grip the legs of the chair on the far side. His father was an international polo player, with wrists like steel springs. His strokes made even the headmaster's seem like a powder puff. Then, deliberately, Sean closed his mind against fear and lifted his chin to stare calmly at his father. Shazo was standing in front of the fireplace, hands clasped behind his back, rocking on the balls of his feet. "You have been fired from Bishop's," he said. Although the headmaster had not specifically mentioned this fact to Sean himself during his extended diatribe, the news did not come as a complete surprise.
"Yes, sir."
"I find it hard to believe what I have been told about you. It is true that you were making a spectacle of yourself with this woman?"
"Yes, sir."
"That you were letting your friends watch you?"
"Yes, sir."
"And charging them money for the privilege?"
"Yes, sir."
"A pound a head?"
"No, sir."
"What do you mean, no, sir?"
"£2 a head, sir."
"You are a Courtney. What you do reflects directly on every member of this family. Do you realise that?"
"Yes, sir."
"Don't keep saying that in the name of all that's holy. How could you do it?"
"She started it, sir. I would have never even thought of it without her."
Shaza stared at him, and suddenly his rage evaporated. He remembered himself at almost exactly the same age, standing chastened before Santon. She had not beaten him, but had sent him to a Lysol bath and a humiliating medical examination. He remembered the girl, a saucy little harlot, only a year or two older than he was, with a shock of sun-bleached hair and a sly smile. And he almost smiled himself. She had teased and provoked him, leading him on into folly, and yet he felt a strange nostalgic glow. His first real woman. He might forget 100 others, but never that one. Sean had seen the anger fade out of his father's eye, and sensed that now was the moment to exploit the change of mood. "I realise that I have brought a scandal on the family, and I know that I have to take my medicine. His father would like that. It was one of his sayings. Take your medicine like a man." He saw the further softening of his father's regard. "I know how stupid I have been, and before my punishment I would just like to say how sorry I am that I have made you ashamed of me." This was not exactly true, and Sean instinctively knew it. His father was angry with him for being caught out, but deep down he was rather proud of his eldest son's now proven virility. "The only excuse I have was that I just couldn't help myself. She just drove me mad, sir. I couldn't think of anything else but, well, but what she wanted me to do with her." Shaza understood entirely. He was still having the same sort of problems at nearly 40. What was it that Santan said? "It's the Datiri blood. We all have to live with it." He coughed softly, moved by his son's honesty and openness. He was such a fine-looking boy, straight and tall and strong, so handsome and courageous. No wonder the woman had picked on him. "It couldn't really be bad," Shaza thought. "A bit of a devil, perhaps. A little too cocksure. A little too eager for life. But not really bad. I mean, if boffing a pretty girl is a mortal sin, there is no salvation for any of us," he thought. "I'm going to have to beat you, Sean," he said aloud. "Yes, sir, I know that." Not a trace of fear, no whining. No, damn it, he was a good boy, a son to be proud of. Shaza went to the gun table and picked up the long whalebone crop, the most formidable weapon in his arsenal, and without being ordered to do so, Sean marched to the armchair and adopted the prescribed position. The first stroke hissed in the air and cracked against his flesh. Then suddenly Shaza grunted with disgust and threw the crop onto the gun table. "The stick is for children, and you are no longer a child," Shaza said. "Stand up, man." Sean could hardly believe his luck. Although the single stroke had stung like a nest of scorpions, he kept an impassive face and made no effort to rub the seat of his pants. "What are we going to do with you?" his father demanded, and Sean had the sense to remain silent. "You have to finish my trick," Shaza stated flatly. "We'll just have to find someone else to take you on." This was not as easy as Shaza had anticipated. He tried Sachs and Rondebosch boys, and then Weinberg boys. The headmasters all knew about Sean Courtney.
He was, for a short while, the best-known schoolboy in the Cape of Good Hope. In the end, he was accepted by Costello's Academy, a cram school that operated out of a dilapidated Victorian mansion on the other side of Rondebosch Common, and was not particular about its admissions. Sean arrived for the first day and was gratified to find he was already a celebrity. Unlike the exclusive boys' school, which he had recently left, there were girls in the classrooms. And academic excellence and moral rectitude were not prerequisites for entrance to Costello's Academy. Sean had found his spiritual home, and he set about sorting out the most promising of his fellow scholars and organizing them into a gang which within a year was virtually running the cram school. His final selection included a half dozen of the most comely and accommodating young ladies on the academy's roll. As both his father and erstwhile headmaster had noted, Sean was a born leader. Manfred de Larrey stood to attention on the reviewing stand. He wore a severe dark pinstripe suit and a black Homburg hat, with a small spray of carnations and green fern in his buttonhole. This was the uniform of a nationalist cabinet minister. The police band was playing a traditional country air, Die Kaapse Nooi, the Cape Town Girl, to a lively marching beat, and the ranks of the police cadets stepped out vigorously, passing the stand with their FN rifles at the slope. As each platoon drew level with the dais, they gave Manfred the eyes right, and he returned the salute. They made a grand show with their smart blue uniforms and sparkling brasswork, catching the white high-felt sunlight. These athletic young men, proud and eager, their perfect drill formations, their transparent dedication and patriotism filled Manfred de Larrey with a vast sense of pride. Manfred stood to attention while the formations wheeled past him, and then formed up in review order on the open parade ground facing the stand. The band played a final ruffle of drums, and then fell silent. Resplendent in full dress uniform and decorations, the police general stepped to the microphone and in a few crisp sentences introduced the minister, then fell back, relinquishing the microphone to Manfred. Manfred had taken especial care with the preparation of his speech, but before he had begun, he could not prevent himself from glancing aside to where Heidi sat in the front row of honoured guests. This was her day also. And she looked like a blonde Valkyrie, her handsome Teutonic features set off by the wide-brimmed hat and its tall decoration of artificial roses. Few women would have the presence and stature to wear it without looking ridiculous, but on Heidi it was magnificent. She caught his eye and smiled at Manfred. "What a woman," he thought. "She deserves to be first lady in the land, and I will see that she is, one day. Perhaps sooner than she imagines." He turned back to the microphone and composed himself. He knew that he was a compelling orator, and he enjoyed the fact that thousands of eyes were concentrated upon him. He felt at ease up here on the dais, relaxed and in total control of himself and those below him. "You have chosen a life of service to your folk and to your country," he began. He was speaking in Afrikaans, and his reference to the folk was quite natural. The intake of police recruits was almost exclusively from the Afrikaner section of the white community. Manfred de Larrey would not have had it any other way. It was desirable that control of the security forces should be vested solidly in the more responsible elements of the nation. Those who understood most clearly the dangers and threats that faced them in the years ahead. Now he began to warn this dedicated body of young men of those dangers. "It will require all our courage and fortitude to resist the dark forces which are arrayed against us. We must thank our Maker, the Lord God of our fathers, that in the covenant he made with our ancestors on the battlefield of Blood River, he was guaranteed us his protection and guidance. It needs only that we remain constant and true, trusting him, worshipping him, for the way always to be made smooth for our feet to follow." He ended his address with the act of faith that had lifted the Afrikaner out of poverty and oppression to his rightful place in the land.
Believe in your God. Believe in your folk. Believe in yourself.
His voice, magnified 100 times, boomed across the parade ground, and he truly felt the divine and benevolent presence very close to him as he looked out upon their shining faces. Now came the presentation. Out on the field, there were shouted orders, and the blue ranks came to attention. A pair of officers stepped forward to flank Manfred, and one of them carried a velvet-lined tray on which were laid out the medals and awards. Reading from the list in his hands, the second officer called the recipients forward. One at a time, they left the ranks, marching briskly, to halt before the imposing figure of Manfred de la Rey. He shook hands with each of them, and then pinned the medals upon their chests. Then came the moment, and Manfred felt his pride suffocating him. The last of the award winners was marching towards him across the parade ground, and this one was the tallest and smartest and straightest of them all. In the front rank of guests, Heidi was weeping silently with joy, and she dabbed unashamedly at her tears with a lace handkerchief. Lothar de la Rey came to a halt in front of his father and stood to rigid attention. Neither of them smiled. Their expressions were stern. They stared into each other's eyes. But between them flowed such a current of feeling that made words or smiles redundant. With an effort, Manfred broke that silent rapport and turned to the police colonel beside him. He offered the sword to Manfred, and the engraved scabbard glistened in silver and gold as Manfred took it from him and turned back to his son.
"The sword of honour," he said. "May you wear it with distinction."
And he stepped up to Lothar and attached the beautiful weapon to the blanched belt at his son's waist. They shook hands, both of them solemn still. But the brief grip they exchanged expressed a lifetime of love and pride and filial duty. They stood to attention, holding the salute, as the band played the national anthem. From the blue of our heavens, from the depths of our seas. And then the parade was breaking up, and young men were swarming forward to find their families in the throng. And there were excited female cries and laughter, and long, fervent embraces as they met. Lothar de la Rey stood between his parents, with the sword hanging at his side, and while he shook the hands of an endless procession of well-wishers, and made modest responses to their fulsome congratulations, neither Manfred nor Heidi could any longer contain their proud and happy smiles. "Well done, Lothi," one of Lothar's fellow cadets got through to him at last, and the two lads grinned as they shook hands. "No doubt about who was the best man."
"I was lucky,"
Lothar laughed self-deprecatingly and changed the subject. "Have you been told you're posting yet, Hannes?"
"Yeah, man. I'm being sent down to Natal, somewhere on the coast. How about you? Perhaps we'll be together."
"No such luck," Lothar shook his head.
"They're sending me to some little station in the Black Townships near Vereeniging, a place called Sharpville."
"Sharpville?
Bad luck, man."
Hannes shook his head with mock sympathy.
"I've never heard of it."
"Nor had I."
"Nobody's ever heard of it," said Lothar with resignation.
"And nobody ever will."